1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Another person has died tonight in the Louisville bank shooting. It is the 15th mass shooting in the nation this month. Fired bank employee firing the shots, also wounding nine others before police killed him. City Council member Rick Blackwell says Louisville can do little or nothing about it.
The state preempts our local laws from doing anything with guns. So we kind of feel like we have our hands tied to a certain extent.
Nashville's Metropolitan Council reinstating one of two black Tennessee state representatives ousted by the Republican majority last week. Justin Jones then returning to the state house.
Mr. Speaker, I want to welcome the people back to the people's house. I want to welcome democracy back to the people's house.
A senior Biden administration official confirming that the U.S. will spend at least $5 billion on the next generation of vaccines and treatments. This is ABC News. The mayor of Paterson, New Jersey, announcing tighter security at the city's mosques after a man stabbed an imam during prayer services Sunday. ABC's Dara Miles reports the incident was caught on video.
Instead of kneeling back down to pray, surveillance video shows a man popping up and dashing to the front of the room. And off camera, the 65-year-old imam of the Amar Mosque in Paterson is stabbed multiple times. Cell phone video from moments later shows a man in a beige hoodie being physically restrained by a group of men, the worshipers making sure the suspect does not get away.
The imam expected to make a full recovery, the suspect facing attempted murder charges. Gas prices in the U.S. up 10 cents to $3.60 a gallon. That jump a result of a surprise move by OPEC Plus last week to cut oil production. Gas prices were already rising as higher demand for summer approaches. Still, though, Americans are paying 50 cents a gallon less than a year ago. Andy Field, ABC News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Agents with the Wisconsin Justice Department are joining the investigation into two police officers who were shot to death during a traffic stop in northwest Wisconsin Saturday afternoon. One was from Chautauqua, the other from Cameron. Authorities say the suspected shooter died at the hospital. It happened after the Chautauqua officer pulled a driver over just outside Cameron. Authorities say the threat to the community has passed. Wisconsin's getting another area code. Some new numbers in the 920 area code will be assigned to the new 274 area code. It's mostly in northeast Wisconsin, but some people in Beaver Dam, Fort Atkinson, and Watertown will get the new area code too. 274 will start being assigned May 5th. In sports, the Brewers are winners of seven of their first nine games. They play at Arizona tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling? I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you remember last week we were talking about this Albert Edwards. He's a global strategist for, I think it's Societe Generale. It's a big French bank. They're one of the big players globally. Been in business about 159 years, they say. But this guy, you know, got a little attention last week, you know, taking my word greedflation. I don't own it, but that and saying, look, this could be, as I've been saying for a while, we're in the final throes of capitalism. This could be the end of the road if we don't do some things. That it's gotten so unequal that, you know, maybe we're going to have societal unrest. And I look at what's going on in France with working people going into the streets and saying, no, you're not going to raise our retirement age from 62 to 64. And me scratching my head going, we can't get Americans into the street to do anything. Imagine. But I thought about this, and one of his arguments is we need price controls. And here to share some thoughts on, are we seeing the end stage? Is there something we can do with this massive inflation? And is price controls the answer? That's why I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernengo to come talk with us. Mateus is an economics professor at Bucknell University. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rick.
So do you agree with this guy? I mean, is he onto something here that... you know, this is, you know, capitalism dying, the end. Do you buy into that?
Certainly we are. I mean, it's a very bold prediction. What we do know is the following thing. So I'm not sure that it's the end of capitalism, but it's the end of, what we are seeing, and we're in danger in the U.S., it's the, you know, the end of democratic institutions. We're risking that. So people that are, you know, sort of angry about the inequalities, the effects of inflation on their everyday life, the conditions of, in the labor market. I mean, labor market, the numbers were reasonably good, but I mean, in general, not unemployment level, but the sort of harsh conditions that we have had for 40 years. We have talked about this in the program several times. So I think that suggests that we might veer away from democratic capitalism. I don't think that, you know, there is any danger that corporations are going to be brought down by the pitchforks and the peasants with the pitchforks. I wish that that was sort of, you know, and socialism was around, some sort of form of democratic socialism was around the corner. But what I see and fear that it's a risk is more some degree of fascistic takeover of democracy. And you know, I'm sorry to say that I think it's a danger. So while I disagree on the kind of danger that that we have in the system, I think he's not wrong in suggesting that there is something deeply wrong with capitalism, and that there is something deeply, you know, dangerous about what's going on. Not just in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is sort of problematic because we are at the, you know, it is still the center of, you know, it's 25% of global consumption. It's still the largest, you know, if not in absolute terms, economy. It's one of the largest, and certainly the central economy in the world economy. So So all of those things, you know, make the situation in the U.S. considerably sort of, concerning.
Yeah.
Now, so you said, I would agree with that general assessment, yes. Yeah,
you said we're not going to get the pitchforks and go after the corporations. And I would argue it's because we've been fed on a silver platter that it's Joe Biden and government, especially progressive policies and Democratic government, that's the problem. And I get this from people a lot. Well, it's all Biden's policies, all these, you know, these socialist problems, all this safety net stuff that's caused this. I'm going, no. It's monopoly. It's the fact that you got a handful of corporations who control virtually everything we touch.
And, you know, that's insane. We have had exactly what we have had for 40 years since, you know, Reagan. It's the undoing of those, you know, sort of semi-mixed economy, socialist, social democratic policies that, you know, provided a safety net. So over the last 40 years, we have gone in the other direction with both governments. There has been, with both parties, Republicans and Democrats. Clinton certainly was in that direction, ending welfare as we knew it, or whatever it was. The sort of mild pushback that we got was important, but, you know, mild. So we got extension of public health through private means with Obama. And we got now, for the first time, it's, you know, a first. We have some policies to try to reshore manufacturing jobs to the United States. Some pushback on trying to hold the line, you know, on further privatization of our economy and so on and so forth. But, you know, even with all of this, Biden couldn't pass everything he wanted on the fiscal, in fiscal policy. We haven't been able to increase the minimum wage. The minimum wage remains, you know, at the 2009 level. So if this is, you know, socialism in action, it's, you know, you have to be deluded. And that's another problem of what we have had. And that's why I don't think that socialism and the end of capitalism, it's the danger. It's, you know, misinformation is widespread and it has sort of furthered, some of the structural problems of the American economy. So I think that we're in danger of, you know, the danger comes from the far right, not from the left, including the violence, I should say.
Now, the reason I bring this up is because his prescription was maybe looking at price controls. And, you know, everything that I've learned about price controls over the years was it's all bad and brought down the Roman Empire or whatever the argument is. I know we had some in the 70s and I've had people tell me, no, that led to stagflation. Price controls work? I mean, look, again, this is just what's being thrown at me. That's why I've come to you, the expert on this. Is it time for price controls? And I'm guessing this guy who's a French economist is saying for France and for the rest of the world, because I don't think it ever happens here.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So, in fact, he cites a paper by Isabella Weber that it's actually on the journal I edit, and I have a paper too, so I'm going to talk to this guy because he cites Isabella, but he doesn't cite me. And I have a paper on the same issue of the Review of Keynesian Economics. But, you know, the point is, yes, price controls do work. They have worked historically. In the U.S., the typical example of, you know, price controls was during the Second World War. They were extensively used and they were very efficient in holding inflation. We still had inflation, but, you know, on levels that were more acceptable. And Nixon used them. That's correct that it's the last time that they were used. They have been used in Spain with some degree of effectiveness. For example, one of the items that inflation has been high in the U.S., it's rent. Rent control is a price control, and they do work. And so Spain has had some of that, and they have had good effects. In Bolivia, they have them. Bolivia has had one of the lowest inflation rates in the world. Part of what they have is they have chains of markets that are government owned. And when, you know, some company decides to hike the price of something that it's a basic good that the population has to, you know, consume, you know, whatever, flour, you know, they sell their stocks of, you know, of in the public stores of flour at a lower price, and, you know, they hold on the price line. And so price controls in places in which the government owns a significant large portion of the energy, you know, companies, they control prices, and that has happened, and so that has allowed to, you know, hold the price of, say, gas in many countries. So they obviously can work. And what's central for them to work is you need a bureaucracy and an infrastructure, you know, that allows you to go and control prices. And you need obviously political backing for this kind of stuff. And exactly that goes to the point that you said. Although they can work, it's highly unlikely that they would even pass in the United States. And if they pass, that we would give the instruments for them to work. So, for example, we don't give the IRS the instruments for them to go. I mean, if you wanted to catch all of the, you know, tax evasion that there is in the U.S. from the very wealthy, we can. We have the funded. You know, I mean, part of the point of Republican governments is that, and administrations, and, you know, when they're control of Congress, is they defund and they make sure that government is inefficient. The old joke that, you know, they think government doesn't work, and when they you know, go to work, they, you know, to government, they make sure it doesn't. And so I think that's the problem with price controls. It's not that they cannot work, is that it's very unlikely that we can get that implemented. And there are many places in which they should be, you know, for example, medication, you know, insulin, which the Biden administration tried to do something about that. So that should be controlled. So markets shouldn't be determining, and corporate shouldn't be a for-profit thing. So this, you know, it's a basic thing. So who thinks that this thing that, you know, the guys that invented didn't have a patent for this, that they gave it up for humanity so that we can cure something that it's a terrible disease. You know, it's cheap to produce. And we're allowing people to die in the United States when, you know, in developing countries, they get this for cheap and they don't die on this. We're allowing people to die in the United States because they don't have insulin. So that's the kind of thing in which price controls do work. And any decent person with half a brain knows that. So you don't need to be, I'm sorry to say, an expert to say that.
Any decent person with half a brain. Wow. I don't know what's what segment of the population that in this day and age that would exclude. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Mateus Fernango, professor of economics at Bucknell, talking about the most recent piece over at Fortune Magazine, asking, are we in the end of capitalism? Price controls possible? Now, as I was thinking about this, you know, I was thinking about, you know, as a truck driver, I go back to the 70s. You, from the end of World War II up until Reagan, really, you had the ICC deciding what the rates were. You had until 96 here in Pennsylvania, you had electric rates that had to be sought after. So it's not unprecedented to where we have these kind of these price caps.
Yeah. The price controls were a normal thing. They were part and parcel of how capitalism always worked. I mean, prices are, to great extent, I mean, obviously, there is an element of price that they you know, they involve covering your costs and making some buck for, you know, the owners of capital. But, you know, from then on, you know, prices are administered prices. They're managed. And so you know, and there are many conditions in. They've arrived from sector to sector. But for example, we made decisions in the United States to allow pharmaceutical firms to take control of a great degree of what and how they price their medications. The model is that they run the risk, they don't. You know, the federal government through the NIH gives them lots of money to do research and development and whatnot. So the risk part of, you know, doing the research to whether they're gonna find a medication is paid by everybody, but they act as if it's their risk, and hence they have to have a huge reward for the risk that they incurred.
Right.
And we allow them then to get out with murder. And in this particular industry, and that's why I'm going back to pharmaceutical, it's murder. I mean, in the, you know, in the trucking industry, you know, it has social consequences. You know, they overwork, you know, truck drivers, you know, because in order to make a buck, they'll have to do and drive, you know, too many hours and so on and so forth. We give, you know, Amazon tells you, you know, next day delivery. So we have all sorts of violations of, you know, of what's reasonable conditions of work and so on and so forth. They don't necessarily directly kill people, like, you know, the insulin issue or whatnot and other things in
the pharmaceutical. That's an excellent point, but we're sold on this. And you, as an economics professor, I'm sure you know this as well as anyone, we're sold on this idea of the invisible hand, that the market will always decide, and the market knows best, Mateus. The market knows best, and if you don't like it, you can abstain. You know, because in a free market, you know, one of the key tenets is that you have the ability to not participate. But as you've laid out in pharmaceuticals, I don't know how many people can choose not to participate, especially if you're a diabetic in need of insulin.
Yeah, well, I mean, this notion, you know, in all fairness, I think that part of the story of we believed in the invisible hand up to the point in which we got afraid that the system would sort of tumble down. And that was the 30s. So in the 30s, there was a decision that that market would be allowed to play up to a point, but under certain in certain areas, we would guarantee. So that's when we came up with, you know, guarantees of income in old age, Social Security, you know, minimum wage, certain regulation and rights in the, you know, in the working sort of environment. So all of those things came because capitalists were afraid of the end of capitalism that you were talking here. I think that the huge difference of that period with the current period is that the threat of the end of capitalism in the 30s was more real than people tend to think these days. So I don't think that the Chinese, you know, sort of alternative is seen as an alternative in the way that in the 30s, you know, the Soviet, you know, the Russians were seen as a possible alternative. So that sort of, you know, sort of scared the hell out of capitalists. And I think that played a role that we don't have these days. And so, you know, the level of organization of the working class, it's not where it was. So we're not in the same place historically. That's why I fear that, you know, if there is sort of a backlash and the system is sort of tumbling, it's not in the direction of, you know, of a better system, as, you know, the article suggests. But I'm sorry, I'm very afraid that, you know, and to be blunt, I'm very afraid that, you know, forget price controls. We're unable to pass legislation to God knows what will happen this summer with the debt ceiling. We are already with the Fed that it's hiking interest rates to stop an inflation that has nothing to do with excess demand, that may already have, you know, led us to a recession, even if we manage to pass all of the fiscal difficulties. And then we'll have an economy, you know, coming into the election next year in which, you know, we have a recession. The war may still be going on and inflation might still be sort of raging, you know, although it has been down for a while. And we have, you know, Trump that, you know, it's indicted, but maybe not in jail, maybe not ineligible. And it seems to be up in the polls and we get up, you know, with another presidency of Trump. It's not unthinkable. And I don't know what the consequences of that.
Well, we'll see where it goes and where it takes us. But Mateus, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your expertise and thoughts on this. Again, we'll have you back to talk about this more because this to me is one of the most important stories that nobody's talking about.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks Great. So much, our good friend Mateus Venango. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, Sarah Huckabee Sanders signed a $150 million personal income tax cut, $36 million corporate tax cut. Any idea who that's going to all go to? They claim it's going to put money back into the pockets of 1.1 million Arkansans. And I guess it's only the beginning. This is just the beginning. She says they're going to continue to cut the income tax, to wipe it off the books. And this made me think today. This made me think, as I've said before, you've got states like Arkansas that are you know, Huckabee Sanders herself said, you know, we don't want that hand of Washington doing anything. Well, take your money. Take your money. Oh, will we? And we'll take a lot of it. But you don't get to have any say here. And this is one of those moments where I'm reading through this going, couldn't this money have been spent better? Maybe, I don't know, working on ending child hunger and, you know, homeless veterans, infrastructure, you know, any number of things. Because I've been through Arkansas. Sorry, there's a lot of work needs to be done there. And we've got a federal government who's doing a lot of work there. So it's interesting that we're taking federal dollars and handing it out. And remember, you remember during the pandemic, states were given a whole bunch of money to run social programs, and a lot of them used that money for tax cuts for rich people. This is where I you know, in talking with Mateus and looking at you know, this article over at Fortune, which I think extremely, extremely important, and this the position that this Albert Edwards takes is something we should be talking about. Because as Mateus said, we're not our grandparents' generation. We're not that generation of working people that are out in the streets fighting for better opportunities. We're now, you know, fighting over the worst stuff. I mean, they're talking about raising retirement age to 70. They're talking about, you know, all kinds of stuff. Because, you know, because as the one Republican guy, you know, people want to work till 70. Yeah, maybe there's somebody out there who does, but a lot of people, not so much. They'd like to retire and play with their grandkids. Or, you know, just have a life. But I look at this, and the fact of the matter is, you know, who was it over at the Roosevelt Institute who said that 52% of the inflation, 52% of the inflation that we're suffering under is because of this greedflation, because of these corporations. And, you know, I cited the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City's report that found that markup growth had increased in the ratio between pricing and what the farm, so what they make it for and what they sell it for, that markup growth is enormous. And that was how did they put it? A far more important factor in driving inflation than anything else. The fact that corporations saw an opportunity and there was nothing there to hold them in check. There was no competition because there's only a handful of companies doing it. This kind of, and in the where there is a modicum of competition, there's collusion. Because interestingly enough, they're right around the same area. You know, I had a conversation today with somebody about eggs. And I said, you know, you ever walk into a store and find no eggs? I remember the toilet paper scares of the great pandemic of 2020. I remember, you know, the fact that you would go into the supermarket and there were no rolls. And there's no Sears catalog coming anymore, so who knows what you were going to do. I remember at the time going, not surprising they're selling a roll of toilet paper for $100 on eBay. Some idiot might buy it. But you go to the grocery store now, their eggs are plentiful. And as the guy said today, I go, no, I've never noticed there to be a shortage of eggs. Oh, of course. So then why the really inflated cost? I mean, the multiples of the original price. Profit. Pure, unadulterated, greed-driven profit. Now, look, I'm not somebody who's against profit, but it's when it gets outrageous and it's something that you can't abstain from, it's something you can't walk away from. As I said the other day, I was going to buy a car and we agreed on a price, and a couple of days later, that person comes back and says, hey, you know, I'm raising the price 50%. And why? Because I can. And you go, well, then you can take that car and drive it right up where the sun doesn't shine. That's me exercising my ability to not participate in this market. Most people don't have that opportunity with food or medicine or you name the necessity. This is where there's part of me that goes, I'm not totally against the idea of price controls. They worked pretty well in the trucking industry when the ICC was setting rates and companies were competing on service and competing on quality and competing on how to, you know, do things better instead of, well, who's willing to slit each other's throats for pennies. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you find your favorite podcasts. You will certainly find ours. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2006. That was the day of massive protests for immigrants' rights in cities throughout the United States. Starting in March of 2006, there was a series of coordinated protests in response to a bill passed by the United States House of Representatives. The bill would classify undocumented workers as felons, and it proposed a wall be built along one-third of the U.S.-Mexican border. In total, more than 5 million people across the country protested that spring. And on this day, protests were held in more than 100 cities. On May 1st, or May Day, large protests reached numbers not seen since the civil rights demonstrations of the 1960s. CNN described the impact of the protests in Chicago, reporting kids skipped school, men and women walked off their jobs, others didn't bother to go to work, businesses shut down for lack of patrons, or employees. The protesters dubbed the May Day event a day without immigrants. The aim was to withhold immigrant labor and buying power to show their impact on the U.S. economy. A study by the Pew Hispanic Center found that at the time, undocumented workers made up 24% of farm labor and 14% of construction labor in the United States. The protests had had an impact. The bill that would harshen penalties for undocumented workers did not pass the Senate. The AFL-CIO also recognized the importance of reaching out to immigrant workers. In August of 2006, the AFL-CIO introduced a national worker center partnership. For the first time, worker centers, many of which organize immigrant workers, could enter into formal partnerships with the AFL-CIO. Working with immigrant workers remains an important front in today's labor movement.
It's always instructive to hear powerful political officials declare that in the name of democracy, they must usurp the people's democratic authority. This has become all too common, as even so-called democratic regimes in France and Israel have infuriated their people by trying to ram vastly unpopular anti-democratic schemes into law by executive fiat. Luckily, though, our U.S. of A. remains committed to the people's rule, right? Moreover, our leaders agree that local government is best for its closest to the people, right? No. And no. Since the once conservative Republican Party has turned extremist and downright goofy during the past decade, its governors and lawmakers have become knee-jerk autocrats, imposing their unpopular policies through a crude power play called preemption. This is the despotic use of arbitrary state power to cancel any town, city, or county policies that Republican politicians don't like. Preemption is an extreme governing tool meant to be rarely used in emergency situations. But GOP-controlled state houses in Florida, Texas, Ohio, and elsewhere now use it routinely as an ideological sledgehammer, crushing the right of local people to govern themselves. This has led extremist Republican officials force some of their racist, homophobic, and xenophobic nastiness on communities that vehemently oppose them. But most Republican preemptions are issued in service to corporate elites. For example, when local communities try to raise the minimum wage or prevent corporate money from corrupting local politics, corporate-serving governors rush to outlaw the people's will. This is Jim Hightower saying Texas lawmakers are even trying to supersize and privatize preemption with a blanket decree that all local ordinances restricting corporations are overruled by state law.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So most recent ABC News Ipsos poll finds 53% of Americans polled believe Donald Trump intentionally did something wrong I don't know that this is going the way the Trumpers want it to go, but when you got 53%, a majority of the country saying, yeah, he did something wrong and on purpose. And you have another 11% saying, yeah, he acted wrong, but he didn't really mean it. So you got 64% of people going, yeah, he broke the law. It's a pretty big deal. Interestingly enough, only 20% believe Trump did nothing wrong. That means some Trumpers, like a neighbor who is now flying a Ron DeSantis flag, are turning on the Donald. And look, he's broken another rule, another crime. This time, evidently, he didn't meet the deadline for disclosing his personal financial holdings for campaign finance purposes. Now, it's not a big deal. It's a $200 slap on the wrist. But again, it shows, one, not really caring about the laws, and two, just how weak are those laws are. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, and all we can get to, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So we surprised that that many people think Trump did something wrong?
I was surprised. Now, also in an additional poll that I saw, they had 70, and this was really interesting, the vast majority of people felt that the charge was shaky, okay, you know, on the surface. And I think that's because so many people have, you know, talked about the charge itself being not the most solid charge, right? But it goes from that to 60% think he did something wrong. So even if they think that the charge was, you know, maybe not well written or, you know, not intense enough or whatever, it's still the vast majority think, you know, believe that he's done something wrong. And then with the ABC News Ipsos poll, then that you had just talked about, majority of Americans, like you said, 53% believe he intentionally did something illegal. So the numbers for him are still there, base wise, somewhat, but they're not there as they should be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is most of the people who I know who are the big red hat clan. They'll say, yeah, he did it. Yeah, he did something wrong, but we don't care. And that's the thing that these polls don't talk about. How many people go, yeah, so what? He's done so many other worse things than lying on a little piece of paper. We don't care about this.
I think, you know, in general, obviously, it's really going to hurt him with the independents. You know, the people that have switched back and forth, people that are vote splitters, they've went from different parties, you know, through maybe the last two or three elections. With them, I can't see where he really could bring them home to himself. Yeah. unless the president just somehow really, really falters, and then people throw up their hands and say, what are we doing?
No, I think he's hurting himself. Sure. That speech he gave on Tuesday after the indictment didn't do him any favors. And I love the way Chris Christie framed it, saying he sounded like a guy at a bar that you sat next to who does nothing but talk about a bad divorce. That sounded, that was the perfect frame.
Right. Yeah, Christie has a good way with words. And then, of course, Barr, his comments on the Sunday show. So, overall, Trump's lost some numbers, and if anything else happens, that will further erode the numbers. So, got some time. We'll see what happens. The other thing is, this trial is not going to be formulated into motion until December, according to the prosecutor's side, and Trump's lawyers want to take it into the first of the year to begin. And I'll tell you right now, with everything that goes on in people's lives, and you know this, you know retail politics and what counts, with everything going on in people's lives, the last thing that people who are trying to, you know, get out there and eke out a living and take care of their family, the last thing they're going to want to hear week after week, month after month, is this trial.
No, you're absolutely right.
They're not going to want to hear it.
I don't want to hear it. I'm already tired of it. Because look, I think I,
you know, it hasn't started yet. But
yeah,
we're tired of it.
This is one of those things where, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I've talked to a number of people who are, and people who are federal prosecutors and folks who know this. This is a little bit of a stretch. And that's where the argument is. Now, did he break the law? Yeah. They should have charged him with what you would have charged any other Wall Street criminal with when they lie on a report. Fine him, charge him a huge fine, or, you know, make him plead guilty to a misdemeanor, and then move on. This moving it up to trying to make it a felony by tying, I don't know. I think it's going to be difficult to prove, but we'll see.
I talked to attorneys, and one in particular, who does not like Trump whatsoever, and said basically exactly what you just said. And this attorney doesn't, that's why I called him on purpose, you know, to see what he thought. And he said the same thing. But the other thing is that if Trump is, you know, cleared of this, or there's a mistrial, or, you know, who knows, with a jury, somebody talks to somebody, a relative then talks to the media, all these scenarios can happen with this because, you know, this is a high-profile case. But even if he is cleared, it's, you know, people that are out there that are, you know, have switched again, maybe went Trump to Biden, and now what are they going to do? Those people, too, may look at this, and they may not say, oh, he was innocent. They may say, well, he got by with one more. You know? They might say that. Yeah. So there's variables here that, let's face it, are not to the favor, at the end of the day, to Donald Trump.
Yeah, but don't you They're think also, I mean, you know, the same way in the old days they used to root for Bonnie and Clyde and Pretty Boy Floyd and the criminals of the day. Oh, he stuck into the system. Don't you think there's somebody out there looking at Trump going, yeah, he's breaking all these rules. He's criming at every opportunity. And he's flipping his nose at this just makes him even more appealing to some?
Yeah, but remember, Bonnie and Clyde and Pretty Boy Floyd and them, they actually threw some of the bank's money to the people. They actually gave them something, all right?
I forgot so, about that.
Remember that. Trump's not passing out money, so they did. No, I see your point, and you're right. There are a certain amount of people that say, you know, the system is inherently, you know, this isn't a Democrat or Republican thing necessarily, but some people will say the system, you know, is inherently bad, and these people were all political, all of them, you know, the whole ball of wax. And, yeah, there'll be some people that will think that way.
Yeah, but at the end,
then there's going to be the deep state believers.
Yeah, but at the end, I think Bonnie and Clyde did end up on the side of the road with a bunch of bullets in them.
Oh, yeah.
If I remember right.
They did.
There was that. I wanted to get your thoughts on Jim Jordan from your state of Ohio. Did you see last week them threatening to subpoena Alvin Bragg? Is that something normal?
Well, it's something that shouldn't be done. You can't do that. And if they do that, it's nothing more than interference. Now, they knew they wouldn't be successful because there's no way that Alvin Bragg is going to, number one, comply with that, or number two, have to comply with that. And then the other thing is, do they really want to take, you know, the House to a vote on this? I think it, from Jordan's end, it was more, you know, trying to throw that out for Trump favor, number one.
Yeah.
Throw it out to attempt to, quote, rattle the prosecutor, and throw it out there to get it out there that, oh, the prosecutor's corrupt, we should drag him into Congress. I think that was the motive. I know Jordan can't believe that he will actually be able to get him there and do anything about it. It's a pending court case. And whether anybody likes the case or they don't, it's a pending court case. And you just can't drag the prosecutor out there.
Yeah,
after the case is done, if they want to try something, they could do that.
Because I was wondering
if they have grounds.
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing, and I was wondering if your time in Congress, no, you'd have ever gotten involved with, you know, attempting to strong arm a prosecutor. I just was wondering if that was something that had happened before.
It doesn't happen. The only time that somebody was hit, but that was a whole different world, was Alberto Gonzalez, because he was political.
Yeah.
Now that's different. You know, he that wasn't a pending case. That was a series of of firings and political steps by Gonzalez that, you know, got the attention, including the attention of Republicans. And this is different. This is a court case. It would be like, it would be sort of like Gonzalez at the time was involved with a sitting case, and then they drug him before there during the adjudication of the case. And you can't do that. I don't recall any time where an active case, that a judge in an active case or the prosecutor was ever brought to, or attempted to be brought before Congress.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to me. I mean,
I don't think it was his
committee
smart
is the weaponization
move.
Of government committee. And, you know, this
and,
is,
and he's using the government.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that amazing?
Yes, you're right. That's a good point.
But yeah. Here, you know, the weaponization of government chairman, I guess he's House Judiciary Chair as well. Evidently, they've issued another subpoena for FBI Director Christopher Wray. Evidently, they're looking into this now. How's it written? Now withdrawn memo that explored avenues for gaining information on white supremacist interaction with local Catholic churches. So is he arguing the Catholic churches are now in bed with white supremacists, or is he arguing that the FBI shouldn't be looking into white supremacists? I'm not seeing the angles.
Well, I don't know the angle either, and I'll tell you something else I don't know the angle on. What on earth was his thinking to bring the two former employees of the prosecutor Bragg? What was he thinking about bringing them to Congress? Are they going to sit there and say, oh, well, you know, we thought Donald Trump was innocent? No, they're going to lay out an entire idea of why they think he wasn't innocent and that the prosecutor should have acted before. Now, the nuance here is that Jordan's going to say, well, so he didn't act, so why is he acting now? You know, that's the nuance. But let me tell you, you get those two guys sitting before that committee, trust me, Trump's not going to want to hear that. So I don't know his political thinking on that either.
I don't know that there is, and this is the thing that gets me. Is it all just about, hey, look at me? I mean, because, you know, as I started today off with, you know, we can't solve problems. We're just not a country that can solve a problem. We can create a bunch of them, but we don't seem to be able to have a government that will solve, or at least D.C. can't solve anything. And this is another one of these things where you're right. If you call those people in, do you really want the answers that you're going to get? I don't know.
No, not at all. And I'll tell you where some of this is coming from. And some of it is also staff driven. When I was in Congress, and I'm seeing it with the way Jordan operates, when I was in Congress, staff would come up with these intricate plots, these intricate ways to get a witness to say this. And I would sometimes look at them and say, why would I want the witness to say that? I don't want the witness to say that. I would then have to dispute everything. I think some of this is like these theories put together by some of his confidants and staffers, and they have, you know, all three or four of them are sitting down there, and they bought into each other's nonsense. That's what I think's happened with him. I really do.
No, I think you got people,
because his the way he's operating doesn't make rhyme nor reason.
It does if you look at it from the position that I take. That it's not about solving problems, it's about creating new ones. It's about getting attention. If you look at it from that frame,
well,
that hey,
true.
let's see what we can stir up to get some attention, to raise campaign funds, to, you know, whatever. Or you got people from, you know, social media circles going, hey, how can we get the most attention? Then it starts to make a little bit better sense.
Yeah, I agree. Except what's going to eventually happen, though, it's like his weaponization. Look what happened to him. Even inside the Republican Party, they were all saying, where's the beef?
Yeah.
You know, like the old Wendy's commercial, where's the beef? Where was it going? What, he didn't have, you know, silver bullets jumping before the committee that everybody said, oh, wow, that's shock and awe. So he does. I agree. He brings out things. Like I said, I think he and some confidants and political strategists sit down and say, well, let's do this now. Let's do that. Let's bring these two guys in. But I just feel, because they're not getting anywhere, if this continues time after time after time, pretty soon, you know, the attention goes away from him, and he's somebody that's not a person of substance.
Yeah, no shock, just a lot of, aw.
Yeah, the short term, he's going to get some entertainment press. the long term, I think eventually it's like, okay, it's time, you can go away now.
Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, it's not a lot of shock, just a lot of, aw, bless your heart. I got to get your thought on this. The guy who's the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, this Michael McCaul, evidently told Fox News that if China invades Taiwan, and we've been talking about this for a while, he believes that there's congressional authority, that congressional authority of using U.S. troops is something, a distinct, how do you put it, a distinct possibility? Thoughts on why this would be a distinct possibility for Republicans, but maybe not Ukraine? Because I see them kind of in the same bag. I'm curious if you got a thought.
I think he actually tied some of it to the chips, too, the chip production, if I heard one of his scenarios correctly. But, you know, he said that the U.S. may send troops to Taiwan. You know, he put it out on the table. Should China invade. And he said, in fact, he said something effective. It certainly would be on the table that would be discussed by Congress. And I just don't see it. First of all, the Congress is not going to sit there and make a debate on a war resolution. If anything, they're going to give let the White House take the lead, and then they can either criticize them or agree with them. They'll let the White House take the lead or not. I just don't see a rally behind, you know, this congressman, because he's head of foreign affairs and he says, it's troops are on the table. That's not really his call.
Yeah.
Unless he wants to do a resolution, that's not his call.
Yeah,
that's the call of the President of the United States.
I thought it was odd for one of them to come out and say that it's on the table when,
sure,
when they seem so pro-Russia. I don't know. It just seems odd. Lastly,
it might sell well in Texas, though, you know?
Yeah, good point. Lastly, I got to get your thought on this. I know you spend a lot of time in India. This story with the Dalai Lama has got me. And I did bring up the Catholic Church a minute ago, so there might be a tie here. What the hell's with the Dalai Lama?
I am beyond myself. I have had so many phone calls today from, you know, friends of mine, because, you know, we've met with him. I met with him when I was in Congress, met with him over in Dharamsala. The Dalai Lama has always been this wonderful, you know, person, this icon. And what happened? I mean, I can't put my mind around it. I'm just starting to think that at his age, he's developing a dementia.
Okay, so we're going
and
with
maybe
dementia.
And they keep his handlers keeping going. I mean, something has went horribly wrong.
Yeah, I'm sorry when you're asking someone to suck your tongue. For those who don't know, evidently the video is disturbing. But
I watched it. It's beyond disturbing. Beyond.
You know, this idea that you know, the kids are, he kissed the kid on the lips and then he stuck his tongue out there, the kid, and said, "Suck my tongue." And I'm going, I'm confused. I thought that's the Catholic Church's purview.
Well, and the fact that he did it publicly, this
yeah.
is my argument about dementia, I guess. He hasn't been known to do these things.
Yeah.
I've never even heard anything in the, you know, in private about him or public.
Because I was saying, maybe this is an Indian cultural thing. Maybe
it's something
that I've never heard of.
No, that's the Indian kids groups are very upset. No, it's definitely not an Indian cultural thing. And Tibetans will stick their tongue out as sort of a greeting. It's an old, ancient thing, but nobody says "suck my tongue." That's not on the website, you know. It's just sticking the tongue out's another thing, but he did this in a, I mean, public, obvious forum with all these kids and families and everything. My friend and I, and you know, she knows the Dalai Lama pretty good, and we talked tonight, and the only thing we can come up with is that he has, you know, potentially launched into dementia.
Yeah.
To sit there and do that and do it publicly is—I just can't even get my head around it.
Yeah, this should probably be the last public display.
Exactly.
This should probably be the end. But Bob, that's the reason I went to you. You always have the information. I appreciate you taking time for us and sharing.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I saw the video. I thought it was weird, and I had to ask. Take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day Dolores Huerta was born in the mining town of Dawson, New Mexico. When her parents divorced, she moved with her mother to Stockton, California. It was there that Dolores experienced firsthand the discrimination that too often shaped Mexican immigrant children's daily lives. She studied to become a teacher. As a teacher, she was greatly disturbed by the poverty of the farm workers' children that came into her classroom. She decided to leave teaching to organize farm workers. So strong was her conviction, she made this decision to leave her secure job even though she had children of her own and the organizing position was unpaid. She partnered with Cesar Chavez to form the National Farm Workers Association, a predecessor of the United Farm Workers. She served as vice president of the UFW until 1999. She was a key organizer in the successful California grape boycott of the 1960s. That boycott won first-time union recognition for thousands of farm workers. In 1975, she was instrumental in the passage of the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. In 1988, she was at a rally in San Francisco against the proposed policies of presidential candidate George H.W. Bush. The police violently broke up the protest. Police broke her ribs. They beat her so badly, she had to have her spleen removed. When she won a judgment against the police, she donated her settlement to farm workers. In 2011, she was awarded the National Medal of Freedom for her life of sacrifice for social justice. Several songs, or corridos, have been written in her honor, including this one by popular band Los Lobos.
En 12, Nuevo México, el 10 de abril, nació Dolores Huerta. Nadie se lo imaginaba que ella iría encabezar.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. So here's some news. Look, you know, you got Representative McCall saying, hey, it's on the table. We might be going into Taiwan. Also, you've got more Republicans saying that we should be bombing Mexico. So for all those people going, you know, Donald Trump didn't get us in any wars, I think the Republican Party is kind of wanting to move us in that direction. We're gonna bomb Mexico. Yeah, okay. Let's see how that works out. Also, interesting story. As they're cleaning up East Palestine, I guess today this just happened. A truck carrying what they're calling toxic soil evidently crashed on State Route 165 near Waterford Road in Columbiana County in Ohio. I guess, you know, you've got the local fire department, you got the Environmental Protection Agency, all the people at the scene. Don't worry, it's toxic, but it's not a threat. You'll be just fine. That's what they're saying. I don't know. I wonder where they're taking it. See, this is where my mind went. I go, okay, you're going to move the toxic soil from East Palestine because you don't want the people there who've been exposed to it to have to live with it. And where are you going to move that? My first thought was Scranton. Because evidently, you know, New Jersey dumps everything in Scranton. You know, why not Ohio? Yeah. So we'll see where that goes. I'm going to follow that a little bit. The thing I'm looking for this week, and I love the fact that Joe Biden is out touting the economic plan, touting the job creation plans, touting the investments in the country. What I'm going to be spending time looking at this week is, you know, how well that's received. All of the noise aside, all of the craziness aside, I look at Biden as a steady hand wanting to move forward. He said that he's probably going to run for re-election. That might happen. I'm still not 100% sure that I think he's going to be the nominee, but I like what he's been doing. I like what the administration's been doing, especially as of late. If we can just figure out how to, I don't know, maybe solve a couple of problems instead of creating more. But, you know, ask our Republicans in the House what they're doing to make your lives better. Ask them what legislation they're moving that's going to help bring down the massive inflation. Huh. Maybe there's some questions you should be asked. Want to hear your thoughts also. You got any questions, comments, something I said got under your nerves? I really want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. As always, appreciate you being here.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News.